At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker for the morning, and that's Caroline Lee from San Rafael.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Caroline, and I'm an alcoholic. Just imagine doing that dance with a hangover. No way. No way. Oh, I really feel absolutely marvelous right now. And I couldn't always say that at this hour on a Saturday morning. I would have hoped to wake up in the arms of some handsome prince without a headache, without that drowsy, budgery, guard cage mouth thing. And here I am with all these beautiful, beautiful women, and the sun is shining, and I'm not shying away from it. I love it. I'm really not a morning person anyway, much anyway. But you know, when AA calls, I've learned to say yes. I thought I was speaking at a different time today, so when I heard yesterday that they wanted me up front in the morning, so that put a big dent in my plans. But, you know, get used to it, Kim. In AA, things put dents in your plans. Welcome, Kim, and anybody who is in the first 30 days. You are the most important women here today. And I remember that the first 30 days were the longest 30 days of my life. When I got into sobriety, when I came into AA the first time, I didn't stay long. I didn't get sober because I couldn't relate to all the old ladies who were drinking too much. And at the meeting I had gone to anyway in London, they would do things like get drunk on too much sherry, fall down, and always claim that they tripped over their Pekingese or something instead. And I didn't relate. I didn't like Pekingese anyway. My first taste of alcohol, I don't remember. But being the child of Scots-Irish parents, it was certainly within the first week of life. It was the remedy for baby's colic and teething problems. And it was rubbed on my gums a lot. I don't remember it, but it happened. Like a lot of my things in life, I don't remember them, but they happened. Other people reminded me of them the next day. Some people never wanted to speak to me again the next day, so there's still a lot that I don't know about. It'll come back when I'm ready. So I grew up in this house in London, which is in England, as you probably know, just in case you were thinking something else. And I grew up with this Scottish mother who hated the English. Now that was a bit difficult for me, going to school in England and trying to make English school friends. So right away I knew that I wasn't like the English. In fact, I knew I was better than the English, according to my mother. Everybody knew that the Scottish system of education was the best in the world. Everybody knew that the Scots had invented everything, penicillin, bicycles, steam engines, you name it, you know, they invented it all. And the English were, you know, just pathetic people who rode on the backs of the fine reputation of the Scots. And best of all, the Scots had invented whiskey, you know. So need I say more, you now understand the superiority of our being. So I grew up with this, and I was afraid to make friends with the children in school because, you see, they were English and they were the enemy, they were the Satanist devil, and I wasn't allowed to bring them home. So I made friends with those who were different, and I felt comfortable with them because the different people were the better ones in my understanding as a child growing up. It was lonely and difficult, but it had its rewards because I felt special. I felt special. It wasn't necessarily a good special as I see it today. It wasn't necessarily a healthy special as I see it today. But as I saw it then, it was good and it was better. And to be better than was the good thing. And that's how it was then. It was unhealthy. It was unhealthy. We know that today. But that separation is unhealthy. That separation is considered normal, but it's a lie, that separation. It's a lie, because we are not different. We are all one. I'll talk a bit more about that later. So grew up anyway with this crazy arrangement, trying to fit in with these English school friends, and yet knowing that I was really superior to them, and longing really in my true heart to be accepted by them, to be loved by them, to be like them, to be one of the crowd, to be one of the crowd. I wanted that. I wanted that feeling of being one of the crowd. I wanted them to love me. But I wanted to keep the option of not liking them back, you know. Do you know that one? You know. Yeah. So very early on, I wanted things on my terms. The first job I lost was a babysitting job. At the age of 12, I stole sherry from the cabinet of my employer. Now, I didn't get drunk, but what I remember about that experience was after they had gone, and after they had gone, the grown-ups, and the children were all asleep, I sat in their living room and I looked all around, and it was a lovely house. It wasn't anything like the house I lived in. It was like the house I thought I ought to become used to living in. And I lusted after their possessions. I lusted after their educated accents. I lusted after their liquor. There was something about that liquor cabinet that was extremely appealing to me. It represented riches, wealth, knowledge. I can't describe fully enough what level of superiority that liquor cabinet represented to me. But for some reason that I do not know even today, it did. And I was drawn to that liquor cabinet and to the bottle of sherry. There were other things in there, but anyway, it was in a crystal thing, you know, and it looked lovely. And it wasn't in a bottle with a name on it, you know, and a label. It was in this crystal, what do you call them? Decanters! There you go, yes. In a crystal decanter. And it looked just lovely, and all this, you know, the golden liquid, and I had to have it. And I took the stopper out, and I took a smell, and it smelled quite nice. And I took a sip, and it felt wonderful. And it was warm. And I felt now that I was a part of this beautiful household. And my fantasy was that I was now part of this family. I started fantasizing. And it was wonderful, and I loved it. Anyway, when they came home, they smelled the liquor on me, and I never went back. But when I first took the 20 questions coming into AA, you know, I don't know if it's the current fad to do that, to take the 20 questions. But anyway, I did. I went down the checklist, just to prove that I wasn't really an alcoholic, I only checked up about two or three things, thinking that that would mean I wasn't really that bad of an alcoholic. I certainly didn't check off, you know, that I had ever lost a job due to drinking. I'd forgotten about the babysitting thing, you know. But that was it. I mean, that was pretty early on, wasn't it? But I didn't get the writing on the wall. You know, I had these two or three little things, you know. Oh, yes, all right, I had drunk by myself. Yeah, I'll give you that one. I drank by myself. But that was only because there wasn't anybody there at the moment. I mean, if you had been there, then I wouldn't have been alone. That would have made a difference. Anyway, I don't remember what the other stuff was, and today I probably could check off most of them, 19 and a half, all right, you know. Give me the option to retain a half. I don't know why I feel I want that, but I do. I'm still a sick person, you know. Anyhow, the next thing was that at the age of 16, I lied. Instead of, well, it doesn't matter, but anyway, I lied in order to get served alcohol in a pub. I had got all dressed up and made up and you know, stuffed the bra, the whole thing, and gone to a pub with a girlfriend to drink. That was what we wanted to do. We wanted to drink because, you see, in England, the pub represented, again, this higher level of sophistication. When you're 18 in England, you can drink legally, not 21. You can drink legally at 18 in England. And so when you're 16, as most women, you know that you can bump on a couple of years easily. So that's what my friend Jackie and I did. And we went to this pub. And we went to a pub in a good part of town, whatever that meant to me at the time, I don't know. And we were sitting at this table all perky. All perky we were, with perky breasts and perky attitudes. And started ordering the sophisticated drink of the day, gin and tonic. And, you know, it tasted really great, you know, and I belted it down because, you know, that tonic, I like the taste of tonic, actually. And it really swamped out the taste of the gin, and because I don't care for that on its own. But, and it was just like a sort of a lemonade thing, you know. And I really liked it, so I gobbled that down really quickly and had another one very quickly. So by that time, I had this nice little glow on, and any inhibitions had left, melted instantly, I should think. And an older, handsome, grey-haired man, who turned out to be a very famous writer, I suppose he was gathering material, picking up young chicks, but anyway, he drifted towards our table, sat down, and started buying me more gin and tonic. Now, I hadn't eaten dinner, and pretty soon I got the whirlies and had to go out to the ladies' room. And when I came back, I was deathly pale. I'd broken out in a sweat, and he was feeling awfully guilty. And so he got in a taxi with me in tow and took me home and left me on the doorstep while he drove off. Didn't want to be known or caught, you know. And I went upstairs when my mother answered. I was too drunk to find my key. My mother opened the door, and when she saw me standing on the doorstep, pale and obviously drunk, smelling of gin and tonic, she laughed. She laughed. I went racing upstairs, and I started the first of a long series in a history of bowl-hugging incident. And by this point, it was a dry heave. There was nothing else coming up. And my mother was laughing. And my mother told me afterwards, she said, I hope you feel bad. I hope that'll teach you a lesson. But it didn't. It didn't. So I went on from that, and I don't know if any of you saw that film called The Lover, based on Marguerite Duras, a French woman who grew up in Vietnam and had a French lover, and a Chinese lover, I'm sorry. Oh God, you'd think I'd know the difference. But I haven't actually had a French lover, so I don't know. Anyway, somehow I got it into my head. I really had a lot of fantasies, and a lot of it had to do, of course, with not being English. As long as I wasn't English, I had my mother's approval. There's a lot of that stuff going on with me. And a few houses down from where I lived, there was a family, a Swiss woman with a Chinese husband, and they had four beautiful daughters. And for some reason, when I saw the youngest baby sitting in her pram outside the house, I would pass by and I would talk to this beautiful baby, and I decided that one day I was going to have a half Chinese baby. Made sense to me at the time. So anyway, I had this Saturday job, Friday nights and Saturdays. I worked in a supermarket as a bag girl, packing groceries and things. And during the summer, I got promoted to cashier. I needed this job because I was going on holiday with my boyfriend, and my mother wouldn't give me the money for it. She said, you need to work for things like that. And it was a good idea. So anyway, I got trained as a cashier, and I went to this cashier school. I wasn't very good with math, but I didn't keep that job very long. But I kept it just long enough to meet the Chinese lover. He came through my checkout thing, and he asked me to have if I would like to have a cup of tea with him on my break. And he was much older than I was, and I thought, didn't care for that. I mean, didn't mind the Chinese part, that was all right, but he was just older, and he had, like, hairs in his nostrils. I didn't like that. You know, when you're 16, you're very sensitive to things like that. Anyway, he was very persistent, and he just kept saying, well, what about dinner? Well, what about lunch tomorrow? Well, what about dinner tomorrow? Well, what about lunch the next day, and so on and so on and so on. So finally I gave up and I just said, all right, lunch on Saturday. Went home and told my mother. I was very impressed because he had a car and he was going to come and pick me up. So my mother was making me a new summer dress at the time, and it was very fitted. It was like this sheet thing, and I said, oh, make it look like a Chinese dress, Mum, I didn't tell her it was Chinese, but I'd started my Chinese fantasy by then. And so I went out and had lunch with him, and he wanted to see me again. And in those days, it was good enough for me if somebody really wanted me badly enough. That meant I was all right. It never really occurred to me whether I wanted to be with this person, as much as it meant a lot to me that he wanted to be with me so much. I see a lot of heads nodding. So, he wasn't English, that's good. My mother would like that. So I thought. Anyway, I was 16, he was 32, and I started telling lies about what I was doing on the weekend. And I would go over to Oscar's house, and I had all these Chinese clothes there that he had for me, these little pretty beaded slippers. And the first thing I would do is take off my school uniform and get into a bath. And he would bring me a duvet, which is a very sweet little aperitif thing, a European thingy, and bathe me and give me this duvet. And then the evening would progress. And I loved it. I loved it. I felt terribly sophisticated. And I felt extremely valuable and cherished and wanted, and I stopped doing my homework and I started telling more lies. And I started becoming the center of admiration among a certain circle at school because I was having this very sophisticated relationship. And I was getting the attention that I really wanted, and it felt good. It felt really good. Anyway, the next part of my, I mention it only because of the alcohol that was involved in it, and I just need to touch those points where alcohol was part of it. Alcohol was feeding my fantasy, the bathing and the drink, and how I needed that to relax, and how important it was for me to be the center of attention and to feel admired and accepted and to be envied by others. That was very important to me. I don't know why. I know today that that was a symptom of low self-esteem, but I didn't then. You know, it just seemed that that was what I was supposed to have in life. You know, I was living now, ladies. I was living. So, moved on. I wanted the glamorous life. I was very good in languages in school, and so I got a job based on being able to speak French and German. I joined the London Tourist Board, and because I was the first group of tourist information assistants, or as somebody said to me once, an information assistant? What the hell's that, an information assistant? Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. I didn't get it either, but anyway. But anyway, there was a lot of hoo-ha, you know, we got on television and we got on the radio and we had, you know, pictures in the paper every other minute and, you know, and it was great and my parents were ever so proud of me. And I was sent up to Scotland and my grandparents were terribly proud of me. And I was wearing my fancy uniform, you know, with the nipped-in waist. It was still on the Chinese figure thing, you know. And my grandparents were so proud of me that they did what Scottish grandparents of that type did, and they took me to the pub. They took me to the pub to show me off. And they took me to the pub, and they bought drinks for everybody, and they introduced me to their friends. And it was something of a feather in their cap that they had this granddaughter. And I sat there, and then I felt like the big shot. Boy, did I feel important. And I started buying them drinks, you know. And that made me feel even bigger of a shot. Anyway, so it just went on like that. This being admired and on this pedestal, you know, and this glamorous life and looking good. And anyway, I met this very twisted man who wanted to marry me, and so I married him, you know. Just because every time we went out together, he said, I really want to get married to you. You know, and he was Polish, so that was all right. Mother would approve. But what I didn't know was that he had been he had spent his early years in a German prison camp in North Africa. Being Polish, he and his brother and his mother were captured and put in this camp. And it had stunted him emotionally, and it had stunted all his family emotionally. And so, you know, he was an injured person emotionally, but I didn't know that. He had a nice car, and he knew where to take me out, and he wanted to marry me, and he skied. Imagine that, skiing. Ooh, very sophisticated. And he smoked cigars. You know, to this day, I love the smell of cigar smoke, you know. But it was all very powerful, heady stuff, and he worked in advertising. It was powerful, heady stuff to me. So anyway, he got a job overseas in Japan. He said, would you mind if we go to Tokyo? And I said, no, that's fine, you know. I never thought anything through, you know. Just, oh, yeah, sure, that's fine, you know. Open to everything. So we go to Japan, and we're in Tokyo, and I have to be this corporate wife. I don't have any life of my own now. I am beholden to this very big-shot company, and I'm expected to be on call night and day for any cocktail party or dinner party or any little drinky booze that they wanted, you know, to put on. And I was terrified because everybody there, in my mind, had a university education and I didn't. And they came from a certain kind of family, definitely not the kind of family I came from. And worst of all, they were English and clearly superior. After all, my mother was wrong. And I was afraid they were going to find out who I really was. And what made me feel better when I went into any of these parties and dinners and whatnot was to have a few drinks before we went. And that made me feel much better. And when I got there, I got to feeling superior to them again. And I was quite comfortable, thank you. Anyway, I got a job while I was there. I wasn't supposed to have a job, but I did get one under the table, teaching English. And that was fun, actually. I taught English to a geisha and two Japanese businessmen, and it was really fun. But the thing about being in Japan for me is that I had heard that that was a man's society and that they, you know, had this thing about women. And so I was going to show those little Japanese bastards that I was equal to them. And the way I did it was, I drank them all under the table. And that was how I showed my superiority to them. It was very important for me that they understand that I was a woman to be reckoned with. I must have started getting a reputation because I got invitations out, by various young Japanese students. And I remember vaguely sort of some fumblings in the backs of taxis and things, swinging around Tokyo late at night. I remember at 2 or 3 o'clock one morning dancing along the top of a sushi bar. Doing what I thought, you know, my version, Caroline's version of a Japanese country dance. Alcohol made me a little bit arrogant. I thought I knew everything, including dances that I'd never been taught or studied, but, you know, I just knew that I knew it. And falling off, you know, and being so drunk, so anesthetized, that I felt no pain as I fell into all these chairs around the bar. And waking up, you know, with the black and blue, and for 3 days being hungover. Sake hangover, ladies, is really a bad one. It's a smelly one, too. My husband could never come into the bedroom for 3 days afterwards because the sheets would start smelling like someone had poured sake all over them. It was just me. It was just coming out of my pores. Meanwhile, he had gone on and got a Japanese mistress and started keeping her set her up in a flat. And the other wives in the company decided that I should have this information. And so they gave it to me, and I decided that, this was a bad marriage and I was going to get out. So I got out of it and got into a relationship with a very exciting Chinese gentleman. He was very good looking, he spoke fluent Japanese, and he liked to drink like I did. And it was wonderful. And I knew I was with the right man because one night as we were having dinner, I said something and it got him a bit upset. And he banged his fist on the table like that. And he broke the leg of the chair. Of the table, I mean. He broke the leg of the table. And I remember very clearly thinking, God, I love a man who knows his own mind, you know. This is the one for me. So thereby, I entered this crazy, drinking, mad relationship. So we got together and we were a couple and we were sort of cocking our snoot at all the foreigners who thought it was really bad that a Caucasian woman was going out with an Asian. That wasn't okay. It was all right for the Caucasian men to date Japanese women and Chinese women, but if a Caucasian woman went out with a Chinese or a Japanese, the Caucasian men got very angry about that. And he received a number of phone calls from his Caucasian superior at work to leave this woman alone. So in the face of all of that, we only found it more fodder for drinking and excitement and, you know, saying fuck you to society. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. Anyway, I got pregnant with my son, wonderful young man today, 26-year-old, good-looking guy, love him to death. His birth was interesting. I was alone in this missionary hospital in Tokyo, and the missionaries were, the doctors were all very Christian missionary types, and the only reason I went there was because they spoke English, and I knew, you know, I wanted to be sort of speaking English through this experience. And my husband wasn't there because he went to a bar and got drunk and he didn't show up. And the whole of the next day, when my son was one day old, I was alone. I had no visitors. And the Japanese women in the ward with me were having their family come by and the baby brought out. And I wasn't visited. I didn't have a flower. I didn't have a plant. And I started crying. I went out to the hall and I telephoned the house. He wasn't there. And he was still in the bar getting drunk, celebrating the birth of his son, wetting the baby's head, as they say in some circles. And that was the end of my marriage that day. And I knew that this man preferred alcohol over being with me and our son. That was the beginning of the end of that marriage. I knew it in my heart. It was like I heard this great dungeon door go thunk in my heart, you know, and any of us who have been through that know, you know what I'm saying. You know that moment when the relationship is dead. You know it. And I knew it then. But it was such a horror, I could never say it. I was dependent on him. I didn't have any relatives, no money, no nothing. And in that society, I didn't really have any support for my situation that I had got myself into. Anyway, it was me and the baby and Dr. Spock. And I didn't know anything about raising babies. Again, you know, alcohol made me very arrogant because I assumed I would know everything the minute I needed to know it, just like I assumed I would know how to be a mother the minute it happened to me. And of course I didn't. And it was very stressful. I didn't know there were books on raising babies until somebody, you know, gave me the date, you know, Dr. Spock. So I got Dr. Spock. And I started reading about how it helped the mother's milk if the mother was relaxed. And it was a good idea if the mother felt like it to sit down and have a glass of beer before she breastfed. And I always loved Dr. Spock for that. So I would sit down and have my drink and get relaxed so that I could breastfeed my baby and, you know, make lots of good nourishing milk for the baby. You know, in Britain, they feed pregnant women stout Guinness, you know, because it has the iron. You know, it's a medicine. In Ireland, pregnant women are prescribed Guinness because it's a medicine, you see. It relaxes you, gives you the calories, got the iron, and it makes good milk for the baby. Well, anyway, so I thought, I'll skip over the next 10 years because there was sheer utter hell, and I don't want to dwell there anymore, but my drinking was on and off. I had my eye on his drinking much more at that time. By this time, we also had a beautiful baby girl who turned out to be brain damaged. And not through my drinking, thank God, as far as I know, during that pregnancy, I felt too ill to drink. And I don't know that I was drinking alcoholically at that time, but for whatever reason, during that pregnancy, I didn't drink. And she was born brain damaged anyway. And maybe that had something to do with his drinking or my earlier drinking, I don't know. And I can't dwell on it today. However, we ended up in California, and on our first day here, our first meal was McDonald's, and you know, hamburgers and chips and things, French fries, I mean, and California wine, white wine. My husband couldn't wait to get into it, and I just jumped in there with him. But anyway, we were living very miserably. We were not happy with each other, and it was horrible. And when he wasn't around, I felt free to drink. But when he was around, he was doing a lot of drinking. And eventually, a cousin of mine visited from Scotland, and she said one morning to me, "You're not happy, are you?" And I said, "No, not really." And this was a cousin that I always wanted to look good in front of, you know, because that doesn't matter. But she said, "I think you need a meeting." And I thought, what is she talking about? Anyway, she went, this woman who'd never been to California, and never been outside of Scotland, had an idea that I should go to a meeting or something, and looked in the phone book, and the next thing I know, I'm in an Al-Anon meeting. Now, finding out that alcoholism is a disease, and finding out the three C's of Al-Anon, that you can't cure it, you didn't cause it, and you can't control it. And it was such a relief for me to hear that. I got a lot of good information, a lot of factual evidence about alcohol when I was in Al-Anon. And I came into AA thanks to Al-Anon, because I learned through that program that I too had the disease, that I was focused on my husband. Through Al-Anon, I was able to get the courage to change my situation and became a single mother with these two kids, and opened up a business in order to survive economically, and the business started doing extremely well. And that's when the drinking started coming on again, quite heavily. I started getting very stressed, and I started getting very heady with the success, and started feeling that old, you know, I'm the center of attention. You know, there'd be stories in the paper about this business and stuff like that, and my clients were high flyers and big names and all of that. And I decided that I had had such a good business year in 1984, I'll never forget it, and I was going to have this Christmas party to thank all my clients. And so I did that. Thanksgiving of 1984, I had a really bad hangover from some cheap champagne at Thanksgiving. And so I was on the wagon again. I put myself on the wagon many, 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 many times. And I was only going to come off if it was a birthday or a wedding or a christening or some special celebration. It's amazing the number of opportunities I found to come off that wagon. Many of you know them, I'm sure. So Christmas rolls around, and I'm still dry. I'm still on the wagon. I'm saving my drinking for Christmas Day. It's going to be a ladylike glass of champagne on Christmas Day, just to, you know. Don't have to tell you. Anyway, so there I am, deciding that I'm an excellent cook, and I'm going to show my clients that not only am I a fine businesswoman, but I'm an excellent cook too. And I go to the store, and I buy all this food, and I'm cooking and baking and doing all this mad stuff to impress my clients that I, you know, I do all this Christmas party stuff. And all of a sudden, it comes to me that there's something missing. And I think for a minute, and oh yes, sherry sauce. Sherry sauce for the turkey, of course. Now, I don't know if there is a recipe for a sherry sauce for the turkey. If you ever find one, let me know. I'm still looking for it. But my alcoholism, I suppose it was, told me that there was such a recipe, and that I needed to go to Safeway and get some sherry. So I went to the Safeway in Carolinda, and I bought some sherry, just for cooking, mind you. You know, it was about $1.99 of sherry, because it didn't matter, I was just going to cook with it. And I will never forget, and I hope I never do forget, it's very important to remember these details for me. I came home, I opened the bottle, and as I took the cork out of that bottle, it made that lovely thunk, that lovely sound, you know. I hadn't heard that sound for a little while. And it was really musical and wonderful, and I loved it. And then the smell of that sherry, even if it was $1.99, it smelled like $100 to me. And I was seduced by the music of the cork coming out. And the perfume of that $1.99 cooking sherry, I was seduced like that. And I started guzzling it. And I was very tired, and I was very hungry, and I was very busy with this important cooking job, ladies, don't you know? And I guzzled this sherry. I suppose in about 10 minutes I've gone down about halfway through the bottle. And you know, when you drink that quickly on an empty stomach and you're very tired and you're very anxious, I know you all know what comes next. What came next for me was the kitchen started moving around very quickly. And I couldn't stop it, and I was holding on, and I couldn't stop it. And I had a turkey in the oven, and a this and a that, and you know, and all this bloody trays and trays of mince pies. It was covered in flour and all that. And here it was going round and round, you know, and we were going to have this party in a couple of days. And I started panicking, and I called my son, 16 at the time, 15 at the time, come. Oh, I said, oh, I feel ever so sick, I said. And I've got this turkey in the oven. Can you watch it, love? You know, I'm just going to go and lie down. And he looked at me, and he looked at that bottle of sherry on the counter. And that look in his eyes was a look I've never seen before in anybody's eyes. And he just said very simply, oh, Mum, you didn't. And I knew that the game was up. It was that moment of clarity for me. So anyway, the next day, still in the same sweatsuit with the flower splashes on it, I turned up at the Alana Club on Lincoln Avenue in San Rafael, and I didn't look anybody in the eye. I couldn't. I was so ashamed. I looked down, and all I saw were these big boots. You know, it just seemed to me like everybody at the Alano Club worked on a construction site. And I remember sitting there on those, what they used to have in those days, those wooden church pews. And it was a dull grey day. And it was cold. And I wasn't feeling well, as you can imagine. And that was my bottom. And I remember thinking that my mother was right, I was going to end up in the gutter. And here I was in the gutter, and I was full of shame and fear. Full of shame and fear. And I had put my hand up to say I was a newcomer. And someone came up to me and said, keep coming back. So I thought, oh. So I went back the next day because someone had said that to me. I'm not sure if I would have gone back the next day if someone hadn't done that. I was extremely vulnerable and open to suggestion. And I had to be in that condition before I would get sober. As I said, I'd gone to an AA meeting before in London after a terrible hangover. But there were the sherry ladies with the Pekingese, and I couldn't relate. But I was past the point of relating now. I was just full of shame and had this terrible headache and stomach ache and you name it. And I was sick enough now. And my son has given me the look. And that was the look I needed. And I was in the place I needed to be. I was brought to my knees. And I couldn't look you in the eye. And that's how it needed to be for me. So anyway, I started this tremendous journey back from the dead, as I now know. And I would get phone calls from women every morning. Are you up? How are you? And I thought, why don't they leave me the fuck alone? I was ever so worried about how I was going to look at this party, not drinking. And on my second day of sobriety, I put my hand up. And I said, I've got this party tomorrow, or tonight, whatever the hell it was, I don't remember now. And I said, and I don't know how to handle it. It's going to be a Christmas party, and I'm the hostess, and I don't know how to handle it. And people came up to me, and they gave me wonderful suggestions, like, keep a glass in your hand at all times, and keep it full at all times, with Martinelli's sparkling apple cider, everybody will think you're drinking champagne. And you know, it worked. my reputation was intact. There was Caroline with a full glass in her hand, you know. And I got through that party and I was tremendously grateful. And it also didn't pass notice that I had a number of very expensive liquor bottles given to me as a Christmas present, proof of my reputation. My first Christmas, my then boyfriend came over with a bottle of whiskey as his Christmas present to me. I mean, who the hell was I kidding? Who the hell was I kidding? I had reached the point where I would have, having guests over for dinner, I'd have a drink with them going in the living room, and then my glass, my drink that was mine, hidden behind the electric kettle in the kitchen on the counter. For Christ's sake, who the hell am I hiding it from? You know, I didn't want them to know that I was drinking, and yet I'm drinking in there with them. But I didn't want them to know that I was drinking, you know. I mean, I had reached insanity. The secret hiding the drinks from somebody, whoever the hell that somebody was. You know. I don't know who you are, but I'm terrified of you, and fuck you at the same time. He stood up at an AA meeting, Betty S., who lives in Belvedere. She may be here today, I hope she is. I love you, Betty. Betty stood up at this meeting in Tiburon, and I knew I wanted her to be my sponsor because she had everything I wanted. You know, she had the house in Belvedere, she had a Mercedes Benz, and she had a beautiful pink Angora frock. And I wanted what she had. So I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said yes. And it was wonderful. And I thought I was one of the chosen few, you know. I was riding around with this wonderful movie star type sponsor. Anyway, she dumped me. Imagine! She said that she wasn't well enough to have newcomers or something, but anyway, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. The point is that I went on in sobriety to have many experiences, and I want to share with you briefly, if I can, which is hard for me, as you know. This experience, I want to say what I said in the beginning, that, you know, that disease of being separate from everybody, you know, that longing to be a part of, fearing the separation, and yet at the same time wanting to be special and different. You know, that real mixed up message, that sickness, that illness, that we are all one, and I know this now, and I know it all through me, every cell of me. I was in the Alano Club. I was about 3 months sober, and I had started feeling sorry for myself. Self-pity for me is the springboard to the bottle. I found that out. So I have to avoid that. You all need to find out your springboard into the bottle. It may be the same as mine, self-pity, and it may be something else. I don't know what it'll be for you, but you need to find it out. Because when you start feeling it, you know you've got to do something so that you don't land in the bottle. You don't need to go all the way to the end of the bloody springboard and leap in. It's not necessary. You may feel like you want to, but it's not necessary to actually follow through. So I was feeling very sorry for myself, and I found this wonderful woman, Jenna. She's from Novato. I hope she's here today. I love her too. Many of you know her. And I called her, and she said, I think you're feeling a bit sorry for yourself. I think you ought to make a gratitude list. And I thought, oh, Christ, you know, I didn't want to do that. And she said, I want you to write down 10 things you're grateful about. And I said, oh, all right. And then she said, I want you to call me back and read it to me. And I thought, oh, Christ, now I've really got to do it, you know. And I sat down, and you know, I'm ashamed to say it, but at that time, the best thing I could think of like that, the first thing on the top of my gratitude list at that moment, 3 months sober, was, I am grateful that I don't have to dye my hair. Anyway, it did get a bit better. I think by about number 9 or 10, I was hitting the big things, like the rent was paid that day, you know, and there was food, and for that moment my children were well. But, you know, I had to warm up to it, a symptom of my illness, no doubt. So I read it back to her for what it was worth, and she said, good. She said, now you've got those 10 things to be grateful for, and I want you to read that every day for a while. And so I did, and I didn't really want to, but I did it. And I had been doing it for a couple of weeks, so here I was now in the Alano Club, and I was sitting in a meeting, and all of a sudden, this young woman came in, and her grandmother had died, and she was in floods of tears. And something happened to me that I do not understand, I've never experienced it before, and I haven't since, but I have heard other people have similar experiences. And what happened to me was that I left my body, and I became the woman who had come in, and whose grandmother had just died. And I was the woman who was crying. I became her. I was that woman. And I experienced her tears. And in response to her, Rocky, I don't know if any of you know old Rocky, you know, the Rocky the biker, vegetarian fella now. Lovely guy. But Rocky, you know, every other word begins with F. And he's a real diamond in the rough, and I love him too today. But, you know, Rocky opened his mouth and started to say something in response to this woman. And I became Rocky. It was the most extraordinary thing. It was extraordinary. And I became Rocky, and I was Rocky speaking. And after Rocky had said, Rocky me, had said whatever Rocky me had said, I came back to Caroline me. And I felt this hot, hot feeling in my chest. God, it was hot. It was like I had this big golden sun burning in my chest. And I started feeling hot and the heat spread up to my face. And I thought, oh God, what's happening to me? People are going to see this and think I'm crazy, and I can't tell anybody about this because they'll think I'm crazy or I'm making it up. But the feeling I had was that I was everybody in that room, and they were me. And it was the purest, most loving, most beautiful experience I have ever had. And that was what I call a spiritual awakening. And to me that's akin to when people die and they describe the white light and going through the tunnel and that peace, that sense of peace, that's what happened to me. And I was told to keep coming back until I heard my story, because I was hearing all these wonderful war stories from guys and I couldn't relate. And I was getting a bit worried that I might not be an alcoholic after all, because I couldn't relate and never heard any story that was like my story. You know, they were all doing this stuff. Finally, I heard my story. I stuck around, and I was a year sober before I heard my story. But it came from the mouth of a man, and he described his love drunk and how he couldn't face his daughter. And it was the parent facing the child, and it was the same story. It was that whatever it takes to get us here. So I've experienced a new life in AA, and I'm very privileged to be one of the chosen ones, because now I do, well, I was asked to speak here today, and it's an honor and a privilege, and I didn't really get that until I arrived today, and I've been so well treated today. And when I heard all you women, all you beauties that you are, all you healthy angels that you are, saying the serenity prayer at the beginning in that women's voice, the voice of women all together, it was like angels singing, and you touched my heart in ways that I will never be able to fully express. So stick around, because as you get older, like wine, you know, in this program, it just keeps getting better. You know, this is one of the few places where the older the woman is, the more she is applauded and honored, and that's how it should be, ladies. That's how it should be. I love you all. I love you all in a very special way. The same way I know you love me. I may not like all of you, and you may not all like me, and it doesn't matter. We are all one today. And may you experience the oneness and the joy of a sober life. Thank you for letting me be on this adventure with you.
Oh, yeah.